Thank you, Professor LaRue. Thank you, Professor Soudine, for the very nice introduction. I've been told I should be nervous about giving this lecture, and so please consider me to be nervous. I'm also going to have a little bit of difficulty, so I'll be using the mouse mainly to point, because I don't intend to break my neck looking up at the screen. That will be your prerogative. So, what I want to talk to you about today, or this evening, is nanoscience, nanotechnology, and nanovation. Nanovation, or nanovate, is a term which actually coined by one of our students, Stanley Walton, who's actually sitting in the second row. He can take a bow later. And I have to pay 1 cent copyright every time I use the term, so please don't come. Is that better?
Yeah,
I was told that this microphone was a little bit soft. Which means I have to stay at the podium. Okay. So, what do I mean about nanoscience, nanotechnology, and nanovation? Nanoscience is what most people think about when we actually talk about nanotechnology. It's the basic and applied research into nanostructured materials, nanoscale processes, things which happen at the nanoscale. I'll come back to what nano is later. Nanotechnology is technology, not science. There is a subtle difference, which I'll try and show you in my talk, but it's basically applied research and development using the materials and the processes which we study in nanoscience. And nanovation is just a short way of saying nano-innovation. So it's commercial and social innovation, and I hope to show you two examples of both, one of each, which has been enabled by using nanotechnology and founded on a good, firm basis in the nanosciences. Which is why, 2 years ago, we founded, my colleague Professor Hetting and myself, the Nanosciences Innovation Center, to take everything from nanosciences to the holistic view all the way through to innovation. And I'll explain why during the course of this lecture. But first, let's ask the question, what is nano? Nano is actually dwarf. That's what it means. So this is dwarf physics, or dwarf science. It's the ancient Greek word, but it's also the SI prefix for 10 to the power minus 9, which is 1 billionth. So a nanometer is 1 billionth of a meter, or 1 millionth of a millimeter. If you compare that, that's 100,000th of the width of a human hair, which is the usual unit which people tend to compare with. And normally when we talk about size scales, we'll talk about the macro world, which is everything from buildings, bridges, up to planets. The meso world, the meso scale, which is medium-sized objects, meso meaning medium. Micro, which used to be the limit of everything in terms of what to think about, hence the microscope, which is typically around about 1 micron, 1 millionth of a meter. And the nano world. And some of my colleagues in other areas of physics will be looking at the sub-nano world, even the femto and the pico world. This little fellow here, by the way, is sort of a mascot which I drew for my colleague who was doing outreach activities. It's called Nanopopolis because nano is Greek. And the t-shirt, for those that are scientifically literate or have an old-fashioned calculator, just means nano. So nanomaterials, which is what most of our work in the Nanoscience Innovation Center is on, is any piece of material, any sort of stuff, which has got at least two of its external dimensions. And in nano, in material science, in materials physics, we only have three dimensions. So those are the length, breadth, and width that we're used to. So if any two of those are in the nanoscale, which is typically without a fixed limit, anywhere between 1 nanometer to several hundred nanometers, so up to just below a thousandth of a millimeter down to a millionth of a millimeter. And those, there are some materials which you would have heard about quite recently. There are nanoparticles, which have all three sizes in that range. Nanorods, nanotubes, and nanofibers, which usually just have two in that one, and two dimensions in the nanoscale. And nanofibers can actually be up to tens of meters long. Nanotubes can be about a thousandth of a millimeter long quite easily. And that's the most famous one at the moment. There's a lot of hype about carbon nanotubes. Nanostructures is anything which is artificially made, which is on that length scale. And typically now we're looking at transistors on a silicon chip. As of this year, microprocessor chips, the Intel iCore 7 and the iCore 5 have been shipped, which are called the 22 nanometer code node, which means that half the distance between two transistors is 22 nanometers. So the size of a transistor is 44 nanometers. That's half the size of the nanoparticles we're using. So there are other aspects of nanotechnology which I'm not going to be talking about. Within a year, they'll be approaching the 14 nanometer node. So the size of a transistor with all its electrodes, all its contacts, will be less than 30 nanometers. Less than 300,000th of a millimeter. But as you see, most nanotechnology is not on miniaturization of chips and nanomachines. Most of the second generation nanotechnology we're looking at concerns nanostructured materials, which are quite often large pieces of materials. There's a group at CSI in Pretoria who are actually building, or trying to build, aeroplane wings, but which are nanostructured materials. Our own work, when we're printing silicon electronics, we're printing things of this size, but they're nanostructured. The internal structure of the materials is nanodimensions. So, you've got these nasty things. One question that most people should be asking, and until recently people haven't been asking, is nano safe? It's a good question. I can only answer it honestly for the work that we are doing in the Nanoscience Innovation Center, and that is yes. But there is no legal definition yet of what nanostructured materials are and what they are. Everything is dealt with in terms of being fine powders. There's a very good reason for that. If you look at these, this is the sort of stuff that you're breathing in every day, especially if you live below the mountain. That's diesel soot particles. And you see that actually the actual particles are less than 300 nanometers, about 100 nanometers. They're nanoparticles. And that's been around for a long time. Actually, a very long time. And in nature, have been nanobots around for a long time in nature. There's an example there. So, if we come to what the nanosciences are, it's the study of materials, properties, and phenomena which occur on the nanoscale. The nanoscale is a peculiar size. It's not atomic physics and molecular chemistry, it's larger than that, but it's smaller than the region of size where normal classical physics, the mechanics that many people would have learned in school and in first year physics lectures have learned. And strange things start to happen. For a start, something which you think is a metal can become an insulator. You can even have metals which become transparent. Some of the early work we did could maybe 10 years ago, we actually had gases, noble gases like argon and krypton, which you would normally at room normally expect to be gas. They were solid at room temperature. So structures change. And as you get smaller, the relative surface of an object gets larger. So the properties of the surface start to dominate. And then you get some very strange effects. The melting point of metals like gold gets suppressed and becomes much, just through a surface effect, becomes the melting point approaches room temperature. On the other hand, something like mercury, which is liquid, actually becomes solid. Materials which are insulators can become conductors. The colors change. And more importantly, chemical reactivity of an object changes. So we can't just, going back to the safety, we can't just say that because silicon is safe, silicon nanoparticles are going to be safe. We can't just say because gold doesn't do anything, the gold nanoparticle is safe. And an example recently is actually the use of silver nanoparticle inks, which we buy at very great cost from Europe. In Europe, they're starting to become banned because they're an environmental biohazard. We can't, in Europe, they can't be dumped into a landfill. And different forces become important. You're all familiar with this little fellow here, probably, the gecko. The gecko foot has hairs on it, which are very fine, and on those hairs there are actually finer hairs, which are nanofibers. And with that very large surface area, an interaction called the van der Waals interaction, which is the same interaction which keeps a lump of polyethylene, or plastic solid, becomes more important, and it becomes strong enough because there are so many fibers for the gecko to hang upside down from a sheet of polished glass. And there are some developments to actually produce, to mimic those things, and people manage to stick things onto the ceiling using the same methods. And as a final example, 400 AD, 1600 years ago, artisans in Europe were putting nanoparticles into glass. Actually, they weren't. They were dissolving salts into glass, and they precipitated to form nanoparticles, which if you look at them in reflection, this is the Lycurgus cup, which is in the British Museum. It's a very famous piece. It's green. If I put a light behind it, it turns red. That is not necessarily nanotechnology. It's not even nanoscience, because at the time they knew what the effect was, they didn't know how to reproduce it. But, so nanotechnology, nano has been around a long time. So why is it so important now? The reason is because we have, over the last 1600 years, developed an understanding of the science and the technology to enable us to use it and to predict what's going to happen and to design new materials. We have, in the last 50 years or so, really started to develop nanotechnology. It wasn't called nanotechnology until the 1990s. But the first generation of nanotechnology has been around quite a long time. It's things like the pigments in the Lycurgus cup and in paints. The most common nanomaterial around that's used industrially is actually titanium dioxide, which you'll find in the paint on these walls. And in most of the ladies' makeup, if anyone is wearing foundation. It's used, has been used for 100 years in catalysis, heterogeneous catalysis, particularly the Haber-Bosch process. And colloids. Some of the weird materials, even things like non-drip paint, are actually based on nanotechnology, and composite materials. That's something which has been around a long time. That's what's known as first generation nanotechnology. And as we move along, things get moved from the second generation, which are things which are supposed to be coming up or in the next few years, into the current one. Things like that are things like nanoporous membranes, which are used for water filtration. senses, our own work, printed electronics, new generations of solar cells, nanocomposite materials, the ultra-large-scale integration chips, the iCore 7, is nanotechnology. So it should really now be in generation one. And things like synthetic antibodies have been developed. We talk about the third generation, which is still the distant future, maybe 10, 15 years off, where there are ideas for molecular machines, single-molecule transistors, a synthetic virus, and even self-replicating structures, as opposed to just self-assembling structures. And then we have the fourth generation, science fiction, things like nanobots, the famous grey goo, nanosurgery. But they're already here and have been for millennia, because all those things nature already does. A normal virus is a nanobot and works like a nanobot. It's self-replicating and it actually can invade a cell, can do whatever it wants, grey goo. And of course, nanosurgery is just the normal healing process when you cut yourself. So, rather than talking about what everyone else is doing, let's talk about what we're doing. A good example of nanotechnology is our own printed silicon technology, developed here in Cape Town over the last 10 years. We take silicon nanoparticles, and this is actually a high-resolution transmission electron micrograph of some of our nanoparticles. What you see here are an image of the silicon atomic planes. And that's what the particles look like in a large one. We turn it into an ink. We do a lot of work on designing the device we want to do. We use a normal printer, a screen printer, which is exactly the same sort of equipment you use to produce a t-shirt. And we can put electronics on t-shirts if we wish. But we tend to use paper and polymer films, and we can do that to produce any designs. And in 2010, on the basis of developing that technology, we won the award for printed electronics, the Academic Research and Development Award from ID Tech X. It was the first of several awards we've won. The most recent one I'm not supposed to talk about because we can't afford to pay for the marketing package, but it was awarded by a company called Frost and Sullivan. So, we developed a unique technology. It's taken many generations of students and the input of two senior academics. But why did we do it? Why silicon? Silicon is a wonderful material. It's got an electronic structure which gives it a band gap, which allows it to become a semiconductor. Between the tightly bound electrons in the crystal structure and the freely moving, charge-carrying electrons, there's a band gap of 1.1 electron volts. And that's roughly the energy at which nature works. It's the same sort of energy for the atomic levels in an atom, which means that we can always connect it to a metal. There's always going to be something which is nearby, so we can connect silicon without doing anything to it to a metal to produce an electrical contact. It's also very near the energy of visible light. Typically, green light is 2 electron volts, just twice the energy of the band gap, which makes silicon ideal for anything where you need to absorb light and turn it into electricity, a sensor, or even a solar cell. It's not very good as a light emitter for reasons that are rather more prosaic, but it's not possible for silicon to de-excite an electron from conduction into the tightly bound valence states by emission of a photon. So it doesn't emit light, so it's not very good for making light-emitting diodes. And it's also that energy of the band gap is very easily thermally excited. Not as easy as germanium, and you find the early transistors that were made out of germanium, once they hit a temperature of about 70 degrees Celsius, which can happen in a car radio in California in summer, it becomes a conductor and stops working as a transistor. Or it's not as bad as something like silicon carbide or diamond, which has absolutely no temperature sensitivity because it's got a band gap which is 10 times as high. So silicon we can use for electronics without doing anything weird like band gap engineering. It doesn't stop us doing it if we want to, but it doesn't need to be done. And for that reason, silicon is the most widely studied and the most widely used semiconductor. At the last count, this year alone, if you check the Web of Science, in physics and material science, there are 26 papers on silicon published a day. That's more than one an hour. There's no way that anyone can keep up with that literature. There's no way that anyone is going to read it. So if you're actually a professor, an associate professor, senior lecturer, research assistant, or a PhD student who's just working in silicon, there's no way you are going to become famous. Not if you're just working in normal conventional silicon. There's no way that anyone is going to even have time to read your paper. So, silicon is very widely used. It's very much a technology material. But in 2002, no one was actually thinking of using silicon nanoparticles for printed electronics. In 2002, everyone knew that electronics, printed electronics, was equal to plastic electronics. The same materials which Alan Heger won the Nobel Prize for in the 1970s for conducting polymers. They've been working on conducting polymers for electronics and trying to print them for over 30 years, and there still isn't a printed transistor on the market. There have been a few demonstrations, but they haven't even been printed, most of them. So, in 2001, everyone knew that you couldn't print silicon. You had to print organics if you wanted to print organic chemicals. Well, two people didn't know that. So we did it. My colleague Margaret Hetting and I sat in my office. We dissolved a styrofoam cup in chloroform. The office was closed, so it was fun. And mixed silicon nanoparticles into that chloroform paste and printed it with a rubber stamp. And we made a transistor, one which actually looks like that. And it worked. Not well. Actually, it was a lousy transistor. We only have two of those left. There's that one which I took a photograph of last week, and the other one which my colleague keeps in her purse as a souvenir. The only difference is this one has electrical contacts connected to it. But on the basis of that, we actually went to UCT, what was then UCT Innovation. We talked to a lady called Rosemary Wilson, who was very supportive and was later poached by the CSAR. And through the help of UCT, particularly the people in the innovation department, and there I should actually mention people like Pete Barnard and Andrew Bailey, and when it comes to producing things like this document here, Cynthia Best. That is actually our first patent, which we filed in 2003, January 30th, 2003, and it was awarded in the US September last year. It's been a long journey. It wasn't the first patent we got, but it was the first patent we filed. And on the strength of this disclosure to UCT, we also had a lot of support, especially from the then Deputy Vice Chancellor of Research, Cheryl de Lorray, who gave us contacts to the Innovation Fund at the time, led by Eugene Lottering, and we managed to get innovation funding to actually develop the technology. Not for what we wanted to do, or what we ended up doing, but for an idea to produce solar cells. And in the course of that, 2009, we published in Applied Physics Letters something that looks a little bit better than the transistor above. That's the first fully printed, fully screen printed field effect transistor, silicon field effect transistor. 3 months later, one of our competitors actually claimed to have the first one after we published. So we showed it worked. We spent the last 10 years trying to find out how. And now we know that as well. So it's a good time to tell the story. What we did know is that unlike a lot of other silicon particles that we have, our silicon doesn't have an insulating oxide on its surface. And everyone knows, it's common knowledge, silicon oxidizes. It doesn't. We have powder in the lab, it's been sitting in the lab for over 2 years, and we can still use it to produce an ink to print. So, but if it's oxidized, then whatever the material is like inside, if there's a layer of basically glass on the outside, it's not going to conduct charge, it's not going to work with anything. It will be a very good optical emitter, because there's a surface state which actually has an energy of about 1.6 eV, which is a good photoluminescent state. But that competes with conductivity. So we need to be able to control the particle surface and the interparticle interface for anything to be able to work. And we found we could do that. And if we look at them, what we have there are actually X-ray photoemission spectra, which we actually did at the National Metrology Institute of South Africa. It's the only instrument that was available at the time. And three different types of particles. Two on the right are good particles. One is milled, produced by milling, which we do here in the Mineral Processing Research Unit, from metallurgical grade silicon, the other one from a silicon wafer. Now imagine taking a $3,000 wafer and crushing it to bits to make a black powder. It hurts. These are very nicely mirror polished, cut with a very good crystallographic axis, and they're the things you make chips out of. We turn it to dust. The other one is one which is done using a technique called ball milling with ceramic media rather than how we mill, which is what everyone else does when they try to mill silicon nanoparticles. And if you look here, firstly, this peak in the spectrum, which corresponds to silicon dioxide, fully oxidized silicon, is much, much larger. And if you look at the surface, you have a 1 nanometer thick layer of oxide. No electric charge gets through that. That does not work. Our particles, we've now solved the physics. If we take electrical measurements, basically what we did, we put powder in a cylinder and press it between two pieces of metal and measure the electrical resistance. If you do that, with the good particles, you get a nice straight line, current against voltage. It's perfect resistor. If you use bad particle and you sweep the voltage, you're essentially charging something like a capacitor so that you get a delay and we get a characteristic hockey stick curve. As soon as we get that, we know we're not going to be use these for electronics. And what we've also found, still at work which is currently being submitted, is that the good particles have mainly a specific crystallographic orientation which doesn't oxidize. What happens is that this is the surface. The oxygen goes into the surface, and then it doesn't go any further. Whereas if we have, occasionally we find a different surface of the crystal, and that gets a very thick oxide on it. So once we have the nice particles, we now have to look at what happens to how we get the charge through the particle. So we have to look at the basic science. Now if you take, we do it as in the second year lab, there's an experiment called the Hall effect, which most people are also taught in first year physics. You have a semiconductor or a metal, you put a charge through it, the charges go straight through, you put them in a magnetic field, they get bent until they collect at the edges, and that gives an electric field which forces them back into a straight line. And you can measure that potential difference, which gives that field. And that's called the Hall voltage. If we do that with single crystal silicon, with our silicon nanoparticles or our printed layers, we actually see something which has the charge transport properties of a single crystal of silicon. Very high mobilities of the charge carriers, which are electrons and holes, but we don't see a very high concentration of them. The reason for that is quite simple. If we actually have our carriers in a magnetic field, they get deflected and they collect at the boundaries between particles, which gives us an electric field here, and it doesn't matter how big that is. So we actually measure with the magnetic field the mobility, the properties of the electrons in the silicon, inside a nanoparticle. It tells us nothing about how a device like this, a printed electronic device, is going to actually work, because what we're interested in is how we get the charge from one particle to the next one. Now what happens, even with a very clean surface, you get a semiconductor effect called a depletion layer, which gives you a barrier at the surface. You may also get some structural change at the surface. Remember, with nanoparticles, surface processes, surface physics dominates. So you may actually have a real energy barrier or an energy well. And that will stop charge transport happening. Now, the only thing that you can really measure is how much charge gets from one end of the material to the other end of the material in a certain time. So when we look at the Hall effect, then that amount of charge is the number of charge carriers times how fast they move. Now, if we're measuring them moving fast, then the estimate we get from the Hall effect is going to be low for how many they are. If we measure them in a field effect transistor device, we get the opposite result. We get a high charge, number of charges, and a low mobility. And it's actually now taken on this, just on this specific aspect, two PhD theses and one MSc thesis to unravel this story. We do that by actually measuring in a magnetic field, out of the magnetic field, something like that device there, which is actually a thermistor, which I'll get to, a temperature sensor, but it's actually, as far as we're concerned here, it's just a piece of silicon printed between two silver contacts. And all we do, using very sensitive, very expensive equipment, but basically the same thing, we put a voltage across it and we measure the current. That's all we do. And it looks something like this. That's the current as a function of the voltage. And that is basically a symmetric diode. A diode is an electronic component which allows current to flow in one way. You put two bad diodes back to back, you just get a small amount of current flowing each way. And that's given because you have two barriers. We know that those two barriers are at each side of the particle. So we can fit an equation which describes the symmetric diode equation. And that gives us this red curve here. From that, we can work out what the conductivity is of the effective zero field. We can plot that. And what we see is a temperature-dependent behavior, which means that we have to use temperature to activate the charge so it can go from one particle to the next. And we can measure now from minus 267 degrees Celsius right up to above room temperature. And we find that it's not just one barrier at the particles, between the particles. We've actually got four activation energies. And this is the latest results that I know. Three of them are the same barrier for electrons and holes, which are the positive charge carriers, which are missing electron in state. So those are actually barriers, physical barriers between the particles. We also have one at a higher energy, 180 millivolts, millielectron volts, so 0.18 electron volts. If we express that as a temperature, it's 2,400 Kelvin. And that is only seen by the electrons, which tells us that that is actually a trap for electrons. So it's a well they fall into at the surface. And part of the reason I didn't give this talk when it was planned in August is we actually found that out last Friday. So, we now know the story of how charges get between particles. When we print a layer of silicon nanoparticles, we have a mess. And what we have is a whole set, a network of particles. Depending on how we print, what the ink is made of, and what we're printing on, the structure of the particles of that network is different. But basically what we have is we have an electrical model for the interface between the particles, which I've just discussed. And if we think of a percolation network, somehow the charge has got to get from one particle to the next, from one end of the material to the other. It's called a percolation network because it's actually the same as when you're actually percolating coffee. You're pouring water through the coffee grounds and it's got to get round the coffee grains. In this case, the charge has got to get from one grain to the next. And depending on how that connects, we'll get different electronic properties. And the simple thing is that at a very high number of particles, you get the electronic properties which are dominated by the particles. At very low numbers, you get properties which are dominated by the material in between. And the interesting behavior is when you're roughly half and half. We've recently been doing a lot of work at synchrotrons on small angle X-ray scattering, which can actually probe the structure. Basically, you take an X-ray beam, you shoot it at the sample, it's scattered through a very small angle, and the scattering intensity, a curve which looks something like this, has different regimes, one which will tell you information about the size of the particle or the object you're scattering from, and the other one about how it's put together. We've discovered that we can take a model which was developed for describing the structures for polymer chains and use that to describe the structure of a particle network. That was published recently in Journal of Chemical Physics. And important things here for us are how many particles are actually touching each other. Typically, in our layers, it actually turns out to be two. How many particles there are in the gap between two particles touching. So between cell network, and it's typically two or three, so we actually have a very dense network in three dimensions. And we see what we expect, that the fluid flow of the ink when we're printing it actually determines the structure, at least the large scale structure. If we print with an ink and we print on paper and it sucks all the liquid out, we get a denser, large structure. But what it doesn't change is the structure around a single particle, how the particles themselves are connecting. So it doesn't change that small scale structure. That's the same however we work. And that's given by the physics of the interactions between the particles themselves. So, now that's the nanosciences. That's no fun without the technology. This is just a few examples of what we've actually done. Our original project, which is funded by the Innovation Fund, was actually to develop a solar cell. We're still working on that, but in the meantime, we've produced things like a touch switch, where if you just bring your finger or a piece of plastic near to it, you can switch the silicon there. Okay, we're not quite as good as a BlackBerry touchscreen yet, but it's the same principle. And that's produced from two layers of silicon. What we can also do is we can take this transistor that we produced, we can put two of them together to make a logic gate, which is called a NOR gate, which means you will only get a current, this light will only switch, when there is no voltage applied to the gate of the transistor, one being here and one being here. The switch to that gate is actually here and here. So if I play the video, you see that if you... Where is he? If you switch one, the LED goes out. If you switch the other one, the same thing. And if you switch both. So that's not a simple on-off switch. That is a logic gate. And if you remember, I said that the charge transport is thermally activated. What we actually have is a temperature sensor. This is one we produced for the conference last year, the Print Electronics Conference. And I had to use liquifruit because I couldn't advertise, and in Europe they don't have liquifruit. So I couldn't use Coke or Pepsi. Also, the guy in the tent opposite the physics department didn't have any at the time. So if it's showing red, I put the cold can next to it, it turns blue, warm it up with my finger, just going next to it. It turns red, blue again when I put the cold can next to it. So either it's a juice detector or it's a temperature sensor. It's up to you to decide which. And that is actually the first product that we developed when we spun out our company. We were working towards this, but we ended up first with this. There's some very good reasons for that. So to go back now to what innovation and nanovation is. When we tell the story of science and technology, we present something like this with a nice uniform innovation chain going from fundamental science, studying the fundamental processes. That's where a lot of our colleagues in the physics department are working on. Fundamental science is the study of fundamental processes, the actual interactions themselves. Then there's basic research, which is actually how those interactions work. And quite often a lot of materials research is basic research. And I can see people are looking at their watches. So. And then applied research is actually using that. Then we get to development. So you take talking then about developing a technology or a product. And then you come to this thing which is called innovation. Innovation is actually taking something out of the lab and into the real world. And at the end of it, you've got commercialization, which is actually people using it. It's not necessarily buying it, it's using it. And it doesn't really work like that. If you were listening at the beginning, I said we printed silicon and it worked. So we actually started here. And we spent 10 years going back this way. while at the same time working this way. And that's always the case. The first solar cell, the photoelectric effect, was discovered in 1839. The first working solar cell was actually 100 years later. And in between that, people discovered the electron, discovered semiconductor theory and band structure theory, and all the basic and the fundamental science. The same thing with the electric motor. And almost everything you can think about. The story is actually very messy, and you actually have to look. And that's the principle behind the Nanoscience Innovation Center. We actually look at the whole innovation chain holistically. So we're doing nanosciences, and we're doing innovation. And when you want to do that, there are three things you have to get right. The one thing that's actually important as far as innovation is concerned, you have to make something which somebody wants. If you don't, there's no point. The old story about the proverb about build a better mousetrap and the world will be to path to your door, it won't work. Most people have cats. But let's say most intelligent, sensitive people have cats. You also have to understand what you're doing. There's no point trying to develop something without knowing how it works. Not if you're going into new territory. So you have to understand the basic science, quite often even the fundamental science. And that can be unexplored territory. And when it comes to development and innovation, one thing that is fatal is just to copy. Whether you're doing academic research or whether you're doing technology development, you have to actually innovate. You can't just copy. Otherwise, there's such a thing that's called derivative research or me too research, and you see it throughout the world. That's 25 of the 26 papers published daily on silicon. It's not going to go anywhere. It will go into a thesis, but it's not going to go anywhere. There's also another way where you shouldn't copy, and this is a mistake that we made. We had a new material which we didn't yet really know how it worked, and we tried to copy the technology that was used for normal thin-film silicon and microcircuit silicon. It didn't work. It took us so far. But at the end of the day, we had to go back to the basics. We also made the other mistake as well. We made something which, at the time, nobody wanted. Or, more importantly, nobody was prepared to pay for. That is also changing. So if you look at that for any technology, to get from something like this, which is a study of nanoparticles, to this, which is actually installing a photovoltaic system, a solar power system in a rural school in Ethiopia, you have to go through all these steps of looking at the materials, characterizing them, making new materials out of the basic materials, characterizing those again, putting that information back into here all the way, then working out what a device should look like based on what you know here, and also using this to inform this decision, and going backwards and forwards many times over, and always listening to what society actually needs. Otherwise, forget it. So you need to keep a holistic view of the innovation chain, and nobody, not even a physics professor, can do it him or herself. You need to collaborate. You need to bring in other skills and other tools. As an example, if you're going all the way, if you're starting developing a technology platform, you're doing research and development. We need to collaborate. Access to facilities, access to other materials, particularly we're using the national labs in the United States, Oak Ridge and Argonne, for neutron scattering, high resolution microscopy, synchrotron radiation. You need to decide what you're going to produce. For that, you need to actually talk to other people. We have an interesting collaboration which is funded by the United States Agency for International Development, USAID, called Nanopower Africa, which is developing solar cells. then, and that's what is the killer app. Then you need to integrate that into a product. You need to work with other people, and you also need to validate the technology and validate what's happening. We use international companies in America for that. One of them is a small company called the Palo Alto Research Center, which is owned by Xerox. They're the people who invented this. And let it go by allowing the patents to lapse. Very good academic research lab. And you need to bring in other materials, you need to integrate something into a system, and at the end of the day you have something which somebody could actually use. So to do that, we have actually set up some very structured partnerships, a three-way partnership. We have sitting in the middle the Nanosciences Innovation Center, with its academic partners. One important one is the University of Cincinnati, but also the CSIR, the national labs in the United States, and also national facilities here like Itemba Labs, and funding organizations like the United Air Force, and important people like the Technology Innovation Agency. At the moment, they're probably the most dynamic and most responsive science funding organization in the country. We had some very good support from them at the beginning of the days when the Innovation Fund, headed up by Eugene Lottering, as I said. And through them, we managed to spin out our own company, which UCT owns 45%, called PST Sensors. PST Sensors is developing the printed silicon technology specifically as electronic sensors. It's doing technology development. We also have an international project, which is the Nanopower Africa project, where we are doing capacity building throughout the continent with US funding and US partners while developing the infrastructure and the entrepreneurship for partnerships to develop an indigenous solar cell technology. So we have all three aspects. So even then, the Innovation Center itself is not just doing everything. We are working with important partners to do both the social innovation and the technological development. So, having picked the killer app, that Innovation Fund project I told you about was actually to develop a solar cell. That's not what we actually first produced. So now you see I have the company logo up there. The thing is, you have to work with the people who are going to use your technology. You have to give people what they want. So the market pull, to use the jargon, is better than the technology push. You can be as good as you want at a technology, but it's not going to work. You need to prove it works. We were very fortunate in that we sent our transistors to Motorola Central Research Labs, and they tested them, and they came back and said they work nice. We went on a joint paper with them, and that gave us a nice push. So we could prove that the technology works. We also had independent validation by another company, a company called Sology, who was a printed electronics company in the United States. And we're working, both as the Innovation Center and as the company, with market research organizations like Frost & Sullivan, like IDTechX, like Palmanok Publications, to show where the niche is for the technology. And the first thing we came up with, I think, was to use this weird temperature behavior of the silicon to produce a temperature sensor. And what we have is a printed temperature sensor which replaces these things. Technically, it's called a negative temperature coefficient thermistor, which is an electrical device whose resistance goes down as the temperature goes up. The difference is these don't really... They work well. Some of them work much better than ours, but you can never get them into something where you're going to get a good thermal contact with what you're trying to measure, and they're all small. We could produce this as wallpaper to measure the temperature in the room. You can't do that by soldering little bits and pieces together. So, a thing to mention in terms of the nanovation is to take these temperature sensors and combine them with something else. The temperature sensors add functionality to these other instruments you need in electric, some sort of power source, some sort of processing, some sort of memory. Memory is actually important. If you want to know how much memory is, imagine talking to me if you can't remember what I've just said. Or worse still, if you can't remember what you've just said. So these enable the functionality of this. A sensor on its own, without an electronic sensor, without a power supply, and without some way of reading it, is not going to do you very much. It's just going to sit there on the bench. So we're working in a product, both as the center and as the company, with a development project with Thin Film Electronics, who make printed memory, have a unique technology. They print Rotorol in Korea, but they're a Norwegian company. Imprint Energy, a small spin-out of the University of Berkeley. They don't have product yet, but they do have a unique battery technology, which is rechargeable zinc-carbon battery. Park, who actually are producing, or trying to produce with organic transistors, the interface between our sensor and the memory. And occasionally a Swedish company called Acreo, who produce printable displays. And the whole thing is going to be used in time temperature tags for monitoring pharmaceuticals, vaccines, high-end foodstuffs, in transport and in storage. And the first demonstration products should be out by the beginning of next year. So that's the commercial innovation. The social innovation is we went back to the low-cost solar power, solar cells we wanted to produce. It's actually, solar power is actually helping a lot in Africa in quality of life, as in the other continents, in Asia particularly, and in Southern America. But it's too expensive. And even the new developments we're producing, the new technologies, are still going to be too expensive to be done as a commercial innovation project. That's where we made the mistake before. There was no market for low-power, small, flexible solar cells at the time. People didn't want it. Or the people who did want it, who needed it, couldn't afford it. So we have to work in a social innovation project. And we are working in this project with US government funding and with non-governmental organizations to roll out solar cells onto the rest of the continent. Just as an idea of what the problem has is, there are still 1.6 billion people in the world who don't have grid electricity. When we went to Rwanda, there only 5% of the population have access to electricity, and it's 15% in Ethiopia. And half of the vaccines which are transported are lost because we can't refrigerate them and you can't monitor them. But there's no commercial pull. So we're looking at three different technologies, one of which is our own printed silicon, and the other two are combinations with other technologies which are existing in hybrid type devices. I won't go into that in detail because I'm slowly running out of time. But this project that we're working on, the Nanopower Africa project, is more than just a solar cell development project. We are developing and enhancing the teaching and research capacity in the institutions in the other countries. We've been very lucky in that our partners in the other countries, Professor Germogoro Gonfa at Haramaya University in Ethiopia and Professor Everest Minani at Kigali Institute of Education, are actually ex-students from our center. And they are continuing their research work with our help in their countries. We're also developed, and we have currently three students here from Ethiopia who are doing their PhD. Two are doing a PhD, one is doing honors at UCT. We're developing the science and technology to commercialize an indigenous African solar cell technology, and we're also developing networks to actually take that out and to do the development work and support entrepreneurship in the different countries. So we're doing a lot which is not just physics. So it's more than just silicon, and it's more than just science. And we've had some successes in the first year. Last week, my colleague was actually lecturing to the University of Cincinnati, Rhodes University, Kigali, and University of Botswana and Haramaya University by video link. I'm doing the same thing tomorrow afternoon. And that course was run for the first time last year. We've actually had one of our students running, being the principal investigator at an experiment at Argonne National Laboratory on the synchrotron. And he's also just had his first paper accepted for publication. We've had our colleagues from Ethiopia running the experiments of being the principal investigator the first time ever at the SNS facility at Oak Ridge National Laboratory. We've done a lot of work here. We've actually transferred equipment, don't tell the finance people, to Ethiopia and to Rwanda, quite often in a suitcase, so don't tell the customs. We've got the first joint publication with Haramaya University, university address, and we've actually had some technical advantage. We've reached 1% nominal efficiency for the material system. It's not printed. It's a long way to go before we have a printed solar cell that's going to be that efficiency. But we're getting there, and we've had teams of students working installing power in Ethiopia. And at that point, this has been a team effort. It's not just me. I'm probably the least important member. But on behalf of my colleague and visit partner, Margaret Hating, and our students, members of the team who are sitting in the second row, I don't have family here. My family is the research group. I have no family in South Africa. So second row is filled with people who actually, some of them are named here, and I'd like to ask them to stand up and take a bow. So on behalf of all of us, thank you.